Welcome to Taking the Rams by the Horns, a podcast that takes current affairs out of current affairs. This is a podcast in partnership with Sowetan Live. I'm your host, Rams Mabote. South Africa is alive with possibilities. I mean, who would have imagined a former president in jail? A sitting president sleeping on cash, literally. A cabinet minister visiting a common prisoner in jail. Or even the post office operating, even when they have nothing to do.
Can you confirm that delivery performance has dropped?
Welcome to the new Sowetan Live podcast called Taking the Rams by the Horns with me, Rams Mabote. Each week, I will be taking a lighter look at very serious topics that half the time drive you up the wall. This podcast will use humor to take no prisoners, have no holy cows, and cook a whole lot of sacrificial lambs.
I'm sending a message to the Minister of Social Development that all these 32,000 children that are here, all these 32 children, young people that are here, all these 32,000 people that are gathered in this stadium today, Minister of Social Development, keep your social grant. We don't need social grant for these people. We will employ them to work and to work and stand on their own.
It started with Gauteng Premier Panyaza Lesufi, and we all dismissed it as a prank or even a bad skit. But now, it seems the entire African National Congress has caught on and has now decided to extend the Nasi Spani program beyond Gauteng. Now, the National Executive Committee of the ANC has invited all political parties that participated in the recent national and provincial elections to become part of the government of national unity. The deadline to form government is Friday. But at the time of publishing this podcast, it did not seem clear who is going to get Ispani to govern South Africa for the next 5 years. We don't know who the sponsors of this resolution of the ANC are. And frankly, until Fikile Mbalula leaks it, we will never. In the past, it was left to Julius Malema to do that. But then they fired him, denying the media many a scoop. Occasionally, though, Malema goes for a drink with his old ANC friends, and they whisper in his ear, once he sobers up, the nation benefits. But what exactly is this government of national unity that the ANC is proposing? Here's what we know. 29 May produced a Greek tragedy-like situation for the ANC. The MK party killed the ANC, more like killed its father, in KwaZulu-Natal and in Gauteng, and married its ex-wife, the EFF. This left the ANC mummified and the EFF wounded, covered in faded confetti from fake circus. On the sidelines is the Democratic Alliance, who have suffered a debilitating medical condition. They have not grown an inch in 5 years, yet their noise remains that of a chihuahua. This has left the ANC realizing that to stay in government, it will need a marriage of inconvenience. In fact, a polygamous setup that will take more than one partner. Zuma tried to show them over the years, but they called him a backward ruralitarian.
Nkandla, Tix was a George Cook.
As matters currently stand, the ANC is caught between a rock and a hard place and a hard-headed prodigal son. None of the three parties below the ANC can be mistaken for his friends. And here we are today with front row seats at a theater of strange bedfellows, each making all sorts of demands before they drop their knickers for the ANC. It has become a jockeying of positions.
Number one, of our pillars in our turnaround strategy is the mass deportation of illegal immigrants and making sure that these immigrants never come into this country illegally. Home Affairs is a department that is mandated to exercise, to implement that particular program, which is enshrined in our constitution.
Forget about the obvious sexually transmitted infections that are going to happen as a result of the GNU. The ANC will come end of this circus, take everyone to bed with it, sonar protection. In the lead up to the elections, they called each other names. Some vowed never to be seen dead together, even if it were in a mortuary. Whilst others said they'd rather starve in indignity than sleep with their adversaries. But in the last few weeks, the dance has changed. Now we are witnessing a strip and pole dance as every EFF, DA and Patriotic Alliance has exposed their bums without modesty patches, putting their hands up for jobs in the ANC's GNU Nasispani could offer them. A government of narcissistic unity, if you ask me. Methinks we should give the country to Lesotho to govern for the next 5 years. Why, you may ask? After all, they seem to have what it takes. They are running our minds down with their zama-zamas. That works for the ANC. Half of them already live here. That works for the EFF.
Someone said to me, if you want us to vote for you in 2024, you must abandon this thing of foreigners. Now I'm prepared to go home. Now I'm fine. I will never take a platform and denounce Africans. I will never do it. If it means votes are going, let them go. Now I'm prepared to go home.
They speak one of our languages. That works for the DA who needs domestic workers. And lastly, they have a king which resonates with both the IFP and Jacob Zuma. So what's it gonna be? To help me understand what we're in for the next few days and eventually for the next 5 years is my friend Tessa Duoms from the Rivonia Circle.
Tessa, I'm very angry with you. So I was listening to a radio interview recently. And I hear the interviewer pronouncing your surname as Dooms. And I thought, I've been saying Dooms and you never corrected me. And I felt like a Dooms.
No, I can't say that word. That other person was the wrong one.
Oh, it is Dooms.
It's Dooms.
So why didn't you correct them then?
Listen, at some point you have to just let people do what they're going to do with your name, hey?
So they just said, she's a clearance. She can't be a Dooms.
When your name gets called, you just...
I feel good now. It's like feeling horrible about this thing. You well?
No, I'm very well, thank you.
You know, I thought they were joking when they said... 2024 is our 1994.
Listen, also me. I thought you were joking. I don't think we meant to take it literally, guys.
Wow.
We cannot actually be. And you know what I said? Maybe like 2 or 3 days in when they started announcing the heads of the coalitions.
Yeah.
And Tony Leon's name came up, and I said the same people who were sitting at the 94 table, yeah. Cyril, yeah. Zuma, Tony Leon. All of them are back.
Jeez.
They're in the room again. And I have no doubt in the ANC universe, the veterans have got a loud voice.
Wow. I was fascinated when I saw this.
Like, I couldn't believe this.
I mean,
it feels prophetic in like the weirdest possible way.
I feel sorry for Mishan Rajbansi that he couldn't be there. I mean, may his soul rest in peace. You know?
I mean, Buthelezi would definitely have been in that room.
Yeah, he'd have dragged it longer though.
Absolutely. So I think that it was a weirdly prophetic thing to say.
Yeah.
But it is a very somber thing as well for us to reflect on, because what we're essentially saying is that the next 5, maybe even 10 years of the country is by and large being negotiated by the same people who negotiated the first settlement.
Yeah. But and, is this the same, though?
You know, it's the same and not the same. And I say that in terms of the fact that I think when we look at the holistic picture of South Africa at 30, too few things have changed fundamentally from that time,
okay. Right?
So the one being the racial divisions of the country. They simply have not shifted in the ways that we all imagine in our minds they have. And we keep getting reminded of it. We only speak about it when it's very blatant racism. But the structure of our society mm-hmm. And I'm not even, like, we could talk about the economy as one of the obvious places. For me, the most obvious one is spatial planning.
Spatial planning remains the same.
The apartheid.
Continued even by the.
Absolutely.
The liberation.
I was stunned at the extent to which this election's lexicon, we could speak about colored vote and Afrikaner vote and Zulu vote. Because we know that those places have localities.
Yeah.
And those communities have localities. And those localities are still defined by apartheid.
The same localities.
To today, yeah. Right? So we have to ask ourselves hard questions about why we are still here. Because there's a lot about what was true then that is true now.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that is true, and this is, again, us having to reflect on what kind of democracy have we built, not just what kind of, you know, country and outcomes are we building. But have we built a democracy that has gone beyond an elite pact? Right? We know that there was a lot of elite compacting, as I think it was Floyd Chibambu used that yesterday. But we know that there was an elite pact that was created at that point to make those negotiations happen, because we didn't have a democracy.
Yeah.
At the point that the first negotiations happened, we didn't have a democracy. At this point, the fact that this 14 days is focused on politicians who aren't even going to their constituents.
What they claim, though, what they claim that they do represent the non-elite. When they claim these are the guys who put their X's next to our names.
No, and absolutely. But in this moment, we also have to ask, have they gone back to those constituents given this moment?
Yeah.
And has our infrastructure allowed them the opportunity to do that? I mean, 14 days is not enough to make sure your constituents are actually aligned to the thing that you're going to go and negotiate there, because you were given a mandate about your policies, for example.
And they voted for you to govern, right?
Right.
They were not voting for a coalition of, or a government.
Absolutely.
Of
I can tell you that for free. So there needs to be more space in our democracy for deliberative democracy, for a democracy where the people can be engaged, where broader aspects and parts of civil society can be engaged, where communities can be engaged. This all feels like someone is doing things on our behalf and at our behest. Maybe even the more cringeworthy part of it is, I feel like, and I wasn't old enough to say this with confidence back then, right? But I feel like even in those CODESA moments and those negotiation moments, there was a sense that there was more transparency about those processes.
A lot of them
then
were
it feels like the last
open.
Few weeks.
We saw them, we were watching.
The last few weeks have not felt like that. And so I just think there's so much to reflect on the quality of our democracy after 30 years, when the comparisons to 1994 feel so stark.
You know, even if it's insinuated, you are the first person who has said that actually our constitution is limiting on this part. This 14 days is not good.
Yeah. Right?
And I suspect it was created because the first dispensation had a 3-year negotiation period or something like that. So 14 days was okay because you had already negotiated. Now you can agree on forming a national assembly. And but this time, immediately after elections, it means constitution was never created for coalitions, for GNU, for stuff like that. Because 14 days is like hard, right?
Yeah.
There are others who are still sitting outside the room as we speak.
Absolutely. I mean, the Constitution just didn't imagine, and let's be frank about it, the ANC out of power. The Constitution didn't imagine the ANC fractured and at war with itself. The Constitution didn't imagine the ANC as not being the leader of society. That is, I think, where...
Is the Constitution written by the ANC largely?
You know, I think we must all be honest with ourselves that was largely a document that came from an ANC, not party, but universe, right? That moment was still very ANC-centric in terms of the political actors and the non-political actors that would have engaged it. And so whether people said it explicitly or not, I don't think there was a belief that there would be a moment like this, especially this soon into our democracy. But then we must also, there's also an indictment here in that I refer and keep going back to Madiba's last speech in 1999 at his last sitting of parliament.
Yeah.
And he pointed this out. He said the things that we have in place electorally, the things that we've set in place in terms of the transfer of power, all of those things were interim. They were based on interim arrangements.
Yeah.
And we have not taken the time to reflect on whether those interim arrangements work now. And then we had Fancel Slabbert, and then we've looked into the electoral system, but we've just not, I think, come to grips with what our society needs right now. I think we have gotten caught in a political culture that has centered the power of politicians and political parties, and they don't want to relinquish that power to the electorate, no matter how few votes they get. And I say that really relative, right? One of the things we're not talking about in this election is the fact that 58% of the electorate that were registered showed up.
40%. And we thought, we were told this is the turnout election, right? That there's going to be numbers. And it looked the same really as the previous one.
It looked worse than the previous one in the broader perspective.
Yeah.
And what I kept on saying about this election is that it is going to be determined by turnout.
Yeah.
High turnout is going to make this a way less predictable one. Low turnout will make it more predictable.
Except it wasn't.
Now, what's fascinating, that's fascinating because that had nothing to do with the electorate, that had everything to do with the MK.
Yeah.
But we'll get there. But I do think that the electorate has sat in a point of paralysis by this point, right? Because I don't want to call it apathy, guys, because it's not, right? 16 million people showed up, which I actually think is a sizable number.
It's a good number.
It's the same number as what the election turned out 2019,
yeah.
Which comparatively to still get 16 million, turning up is still good.
Yeah.
It's better than 2021 where only 12 million showed up. So I think we were all pumping for not going down because
yes.
That would have been far worse.
Yeah.
But in real time, we have more eligible voters. So we had only 40% of all people over 18 show up. This is including people who did not register.
Yeah.
That is a big indictment on the country at this point. It still means that people don't see politics as a real vehicle for change. They don't see the ballot anymore as this powerful tool for change. And we have to ask ourselves questions about why that is. What does that mean for the kind of politics that we have? What does it mean for the kind of politicians we have? What does it mean for our institutions? The other thing that this election has thrown up from the point of the voter, and I know that the party politics kind of muddies this conversation a little bit. But the trust in institutions like the IEC is low.
Yeah.
We have to reflect on the fact that that's true. And so, yes, that could play into narratives, political narratives all day long. But as the electorate, we need to sit with each other and have a real conversation about the fact that our trust in these institutions
but the trust, are low. The trust in that particular institution, the IEC, seemed to me engineered, right? I mean, a mistrust was thrown even before we cast our ballot. And the fact that then there were mistakes, and there were mistakes, and then, you know, we lost electricity or whatever, they lost the connectivity, blah, 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 played to that trap that was set before.
I don't think, and that's why I say, I think we must separate the two things out, because I think the politicians played on a fear that's been bubbling up in the electorate generally, right? And I think that fear is, can we trust our institutions? Have our institutions built trust with the people? So we talk about trust in the politicians,
yeah. You
know, freely. Well, politicians can't be trusted. The electorate doesn't trust politicians. But we don't talk with the same freedom about how we as communities and the electorate feel about all institutions. And yes, again, politics will always leverage those things. But can we have conversations about what has the IEC done to build confidence in the electorate? Have they responded to the idea that there is low trust in the IEC and whether the IEC is captured or not? Have they gone out and done the kind of voter education that helps people understand why they can
vote?
Even
I was confused about this.
Absolutely.
This three ballot thingy. And then there was a section something or the other. I even thought I was arrested. I was not sure what was happening.
Sometimes I think what we've done in our democracy is we have assumed that the authority that institutions hold will cause everybody just to go, yeah, we agree with what the institution says because it's an institution of authority. And they're not giving people the information with which to weigh the rightness or wrongness of an argument against an institution on their own terms.
Okay, let's go back to GNU,
yeah.
Which is why I brought you here, you know, this GNU thingy. Look, it seems to me outside the MK, everybody is in the room. Everybody is trying to see what role they could play.
Sure.
In fact, what they could get out of the GNU.
I wish that was an easy answer. So maybe let's start with why I don't think this is a GNU. I really don't think.
Well, as I said in my intro, it looks more like a government of narcissistic unity, but yeah.
So I'm calling it a coalition of the willing.
Okay.
Whoever's willing can come.
Can come, yeah.
Whoever's willing can come. But a GNU in its essence has always been applied not for an electoral outcome, but to manage a societal issue around that electoral outcome, right? So if you think about in Zimbabwe, when there was a GNU that brought in Morgan.
Yeah.
That's because there was actual violence
yes.
that was at stake and the questioning of the validity of the election. There was like a real crisis on yeah. the ground. Same thing happened in Kenya when Odinga got made prime minister. The outcome was clear.
Yeah.
But the violence needed to be managed. Our own is even more interesting. The 1994 Government of National Unity was decided before the election.
Mm.
It was a precondition to the election being held.
Yeah.
It was an extra electoral decision
yeah.
to manage something happening in society, not the electoral outcome per se.
Yeah.
Right? So GNU usually says, we can see who the winner is, but there's something else we need to
yeah.
manage for here politically.
Yeah.
In this case, I have no idea what we're managing for. The ANC needs a coalition, right? And a coalition is about numbers. It's about getting to the 50% so that you have a coalition of people who can.
Then why is the ANC not getting into a coalition? There's like enough choices, right?
And there's so many choices. And there are choices that don't involve the DA because everyone's going to go, oh, this is a cover up for the markets. There are choices where the numbers work out
yeah.
without the DA. In fact, if the ANC took everybody except the DA, they could form a coalition. If they took everybody except the DA.
But would everybody sit in that coalition?
No. At this point, we don't know.
Like ATM and the ANC. Forget even about MTA, right?
We don't know. We don't know the answer to that right now, right? I'm going to get to what I think we need, how we need to talk about this moment now.
Yeah.
But the ANC had so many options for forming a coalition that I think it just baffles me. When they came out and said Government of National Unity, I blinked a lot because I was waiting to hear why. What is the thing that you're trying to solve for with the Government of National Unity? And frankly, my answer is leadership. They're trying to solve for not being able to take a decisive lead.
In fact, I was about to say that for me, that was the greatest indecision.
Absolutely.
Of decisiveness or decisive indecision.
Absolutely.
I don't even know. Like, you know, here we are, we've taken a decision, but it's actually not a decision.
It was a decision that wasn't a decision. That's a perfect phrasing of it. It felt to me like the ANC spent that day in the NEC coming up with all sorts of scenarios, clashing amongst each other. And when time ran out, they just went, let the other parties decide for us. And I think that for me is a cop-out. There's a cop-out embedded in this that I think we must confront. The problem that it's created for us is that we don't know what the basis of the negotiations are right now. We have no clue. And what that does is created this vacuum, this information vacuum, that's filled with political narratives from every corner, right? So we started with the markets narrative. Then we went into the puppeteering narrative. Then it went into the black versus white. Now we're just filling it with narratives because we don't actually have, especially from the side of the ANC, what the negotiations are based on. I think of all of the parties that I've heard speak on this so far, the EFF have probably been the most transparent about what their conditionalities are. They came out and said, this is the list of issues that we're taking in. I have not heard the DA just come out and clearly say. I mean, I've seen some, you know, whisperings through the Daily Maverick here or whisperings there. A lot of gossip. Very little, like, just upfront. This is the position
that
we're taking
in. But we don't know officially what they want.
Exactly. The official statement from the ANC is the most vague one we've had of all of the parties. You must believe in the Constitution. Come on, guys. Like, what does that even mean in English, right? So does that mean if I want to change one clause in the Constitution, I'm out?
I'm out, yeah.
You know, like, you know, where do we stand? The thing that surprised me the most about the ANC around the GNU issue was the question about thresholds. So last year, Paul Mashatile, as deputy president of the country, actually convened everybody around the question of coalitions, guys. They convened everybody who was in parliament at the time, most of which have returned to parliament
yeah.
now. And they convened some parties that weren't in parliament to the utter irritation of the ATM who walked out. I'll never forget that because I thought it was quite important. But they had the foresight to start talking about coalitions last year already. And the one non-negotiable that Paul Mashatile kept putting on the table was the idea of thresholds. Mm-hmm. And his thresholds was even a higher threshold. It was a threshold about what having 1% even to make it into parliament. Now we have a GNU announced by the same ANC, and they don't even announce a threshold.
A threshold, right? I mean, we had a threshold in 1994,
we had a threshold in 94.
Yeah.
And now it's a free-for-all. If you got 0.2% of the vote, or if you got 60% of the vote, all everybody's welcome. It's a very strange thing
because
it gives very, very little guidance.
I think it's indicative of the reality of the ANC. They don't even see things the same way, all of them.
Absolutely.
So rather let's throw it out to other guys and they must tell us where to go with this thing. And whoever is more convincing, we go with them. It sounds like it.
Yeah, that's what it feels like, right? And I think the ANC's own internal crises of the last 15 to 20 years, I would actually say, has turned itself public-facing in a way that we've never seen before in this election. I would say we've ended up with 2013 ANC in three different versions now facing society, right? All of the people who are ANC, EFF, MK, who are leading those spaces, were all in the ANC in 2012-2013. So really, we're back there. But the internal factions of the ANC have now turned outward facing. They've broken apart.
I refer to it as a Greek tragedy. This is a Greek tragedy.
Absolutely.
This is, really, when you know somebody comes and kills their father and then marries their mother, and then you know, like, it's a Greek tragedy. But it seems though, and I'm hoping the ANC would pay me for speaking for them now, that KZN could be solving the problem for ANC. From what we're hearing as you and I speak now, is that there seems to be some conversation with some parties to form a coalition.
I mean, what is your definition of solving?
It could lead the national ANC to say, maybe that's the route we take then.
So, again, this would just require courage in leadership, right? Say with your chest what it is that you prefer mm-hmm. and what it is that you are solving for. And I think if the ANC was saying with their chest what they are solving for, society would have a different reaction to it. Now it looks like, or anything could be possible, because all sorts of narratives get to dominate when the ANC is not saying, what we are trying to solve for is keeping MK out. Say that. You know, if that's what you're trying to solve for, say that we're not solving here for policy. We're solving for politically managing a particular party. Then we know what we're doing. If, in fact, and really I did not anticipate this, just seriously speaking, maybe because I assumed that MK at 45 would just mean that they would go out, beeline to the IFP, and just say to the IFP, let's talk and form a government. It just seemed like the natural course of events in my mind. So I'm a bit surprised that the MK have not secured a governance position with the IFP.
Yeah, but because they sound like the old and new of the same thing.
I don't even think it's that. I think just at a pure coalitions basis, the two highest parties there that are not ideologically completely diametrically opposed to each other, but in some ways it won't even matter because the MK party is probably further away in terms of many things from the ANC right now politically. So just politically, it's easier with the IFP because you don't
have... Is it though? I disagree.
Why?
I think that politically they're actually closer to the to the ANC than they are to the IFP.
You might be talking about it in terms of like...
But they speak leftist language. I mean, we know that it's posturing, but language they speak...
So you're talking ideologically, and I'm not talking ideologically. I'm talking about what's politically manageable.
Okay.
Right, so in terms of political management... Getting MK to have a conversation with the ANC, there are many political difficulties.
The ANC of Ramaphosa.
The ANC of Ramaphosa, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But there are less political issues to overcome with the IFP.
They would even have that conversation in Zulu.
Right. And the IFP has been the most resilient in KZN to the MK's onslaught.
Yeah.
I mean, the MK decimated.
It decimated the ANC completely.
The ANC decimated everybody in KZN. So it just politically, I thought that that's what the MK party would do almost instantly. So I think what's happening now is either that the MK party have just said, we're not going to participate in this.
Well, my question is different. Have they outfoxed themselves? You know, now the fires to try and interdict parliament from sitting, all these other things, complaining, insisting on recounts of vote or even re-voting. Have they outfoxed themselves? Has our Garry Kasparov played chess badly this time?
It depends on what outcome they're pursuing. And so if the outcome is about delegitimizing institutions, then we're far from the end. Then it, because, I mean, the sitting will happen just if you look at time,
yeah.
Right? The timing of taking the, or filing the Constitutional Court papers makes it very difficult for, even if they were to hear it mm-hmm. and to ask for an interdict, the timing is wrong. But that timing doesn't feel accidental. I don't think that the MK party knew last week that it wanted to file and then decided only to file this week in a clumsy manner. I am asking myself, is the filing, is the timing of the filing accidental or not?
What I've heard repeatedly sounds like they actually also do not understand how this thing works, which is also strange because I tend to suspect, and I could be wrong, that the leader was in presidency for almost 2 decades.
You see, I think we're also assuming a lot from everybody else, right? We are assuming that we are all right and MK is wrong, that everybody is right. The truth is, actually, asking clarity from the Constitutional Court is not a wrong thing to do
yeah.
on a constitutional matter. Now, a few weeks ago, we had the IEC go to the Concord to seek clarity on the Constitution.
Yeah.
Right? Urgent basis, all of that is true. And there were people who said initially, the IEC shouldn't have done that.
Mm.
They shouldn't have. But what we found is that it was absolutely necessary for the IEC to
yeah.
do that because the IEC itself did not know how it would interpret the Constitution going forward. So if we are sure, all of us, on what basis are we sure that we all know what the Constitution says? So I'm not mad at MK for seeking constitutional clarity. I'm not mad at them. I'm not the Constitutional Court. I'm not going to tell them. I'm not even a lawyer. Who yep. am I to say, you guys are wrong on your interpretation? Others might say it with more confidence mm-hmm. than I can. But I certainly am not going to pretend to know what the best interpretation of the Constitution is vis-a-vis someone who was president for almost a decade, right?
Yeah, well, in the presidency for 2 decades.
But let's not underplay the idea that it is the right thing to do to seek constitutional clarity from the Constitutional Court on a constitutional issue. That I'm not going to. It may play into the politics of the day, and that's one separate thing. But let's not muddy matters. So that if we find ourselves in a similar situation in future, that we don't set a precedent based on who is asking, but we always set the precedent on what is the right thing to do. And the right thing to do is if there's an interpretation of the Constitution that needs to be clarified by anyone, especially when it's consequential, let the Constitutional Court do it.
I'm going to drag you back again to the GNU. Now, the beautiful Brandhurst Foundation have again come out with a poll that tells
so
us,
tired.
You know, the DA-ANC poll is rather, you know, coalition is the best for the country. Should we take them seriously? You know, I have battled throughout the elections with the Brandhurst Foundation, but they're the first one to come out now, you know, with the 43 people they interviewed.
I'm not going to comment on the 43 people issue. Here is what I will say about that.
Yeah.
Right? This is, again, why the problem with the 14 days is such a clear problem. I think it is important in a coalition discussion, not just the GNU discussion, in a coalition discussion of any kind in a country, to have as many stakeholders weigh in as possible, not just the loudest stakeholders.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in a scenario like the one we have right now, it is going to be the loudest stakeholders, somewhere between the political parties, the media. I mean, we were in the middle of counting when business came out with their preferences. I was like, what are you doing, bro? The board is still tallying. What are you guys doing?
And
right?
Shouldn't business work with the government of the day? I mean, it doesn't matter. It's not your say.
I don't, my thing is, we all are stakeholders. And so in a better scenario, you would have stakeholders from society weighing in. And I do think that that is necessary. So I don't bemoan business or media or anyone or the Brenthurst and all 43 of their people on weighing in what their preferences are.
Yeah.
In an ideal situation, you would actually want a considered process of different stakeholders being able to weigh in. And so I would prefer that, right?
So let me help you to say what you want to say. You would have preferred the Brenthurst Foundation to tell us what they prefer, not to present it as a poll to us.
No. I mean, that too. That would be great. Yeah. Just say what you want with your chest, right? But what I am saying is that there's a principle here. There's a principle matter. So even if we wanted to use polling, I would prefer that we didn't have to use polling, that we had other means to go and test society and go and engage with society as stakeholders rather than just as, you know, it's almost like your poll is similar to us taking kind of a snapshot of what happens on Twitter and saying that that's what society thinks. I just think that this is a complex enough thing that we need to be able to have the space to breathe as a society, to consider it as a society, and to work through the various contradictions, difficulties, complexities of these kinds of things, especially in a society that is as divided as ours. If societies in other parts of the world can take 3 to 6 months to a year when they are more homogenous than we are to put up coalitions, just ordinary coalitions, why on earth would we think that we are going to be able to test the pulse of a country? A country where the majority of people right now don't know that a GNU is being negotiated. The majority of the country does not know that a GNU right now is being negotiated on their behalf. We don't have a political edifice or a political system where parties feel compelled to go to their constituents. We just don't have the right things in place for this. And again, lessons need to be learned from this. We do the best with what we have, sure, but lessons definitely need to be learned. Otherwise, you will always have voices that will be louder than others, that will lead things, and then we will all be throwing stones from the outside saying, why didn't you come to me? Because we have not required better from our institutions, our systems, our processes, or our parties.
So whether it takes 14 days, which is pretty much tomorrow, or 14 weeks, whatever it is, right? What are the likely scenarios, the good, the bad, and the completely unlikely? No, I don't want to say ugly. You know, what do you think could happen? Not will, but could happen.
So many things are possible. I was saying that a week is a long time in politics has never been so as true.
Look, I've been talking to you for almost 25 minutes. I think it's already a long time. Anything could be happening as you speak.
Happening right now, right? Yeah. So here's what I think we all need to be paying attention to in the next few days.
Yeah.
The first thing is the first sitting of Parliament, right? I think that because we haven't heard from the Concord yet, we can assume that that first sitting is going to happen.
Yeah.
Right?
With or without Jabulani Khumalo.
With or without Jabulani Khumalo. I think at this point, the majority of parties would have been spoken to by now.
Yeah.
All 17 other parties other than the ANC.
Yeah.
The ANC gave itself a task of talking to 17 parties, because there are 18 represented in Parliament, which I think was a ridiculous idea. But we should assume that the majority of them have at least had their bilaterals by now, and we'll start getting a sense of who's in and out.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm curious to know is how many parties have opted in and are willing to work together, and then you have to look out for the balance of those parties in terms of ideology and policy. My sense is if you look at Parliament right now, not by sheer number, but in terms of number of parties, that there's a high concentration of parties that are very conservative either in values or in their economic posture.
Mm-hmm.
And so we must already brace ourselves for that. I mean, we can talk about the DA all day
long.
So
we must brace ourselves for a centre-right.
We must brace ourselves for a centre-right positioning. Of the at least of the number of parties that are going to be sitting there.
Yeah.
So the DA is sitting there with the biggest share of the vote. But we must ask ourselves, who else will opt in? Will FF Plus opt in? Probably.
Yeah.
Will ACDP opt in?
Yeah.
If the DA is there, if the FF Plus is there, probably.
Yeah.
The PA will opt in. At a values level, at minimum,
yeah,
they're definitely on the right and more conservative. So we have actually stacked ourselves with a more conservative leaning values and economic base parliament, which means if the majority of them opt in, you're going to have a more right-leaning government and parliament. The second thing you must look at,
which
though,
validates the Prentice Foundation's.
No.
I keep on going, because they say the markets are going to be happy if we go that route, right?
I don't care what the markets are going to be happy about. And I say that very flippantly, but let me qualify that.
Yeah.
Right? People say this kind of, the markets will react in certain ways. The markets, we must ask the markets what they want.
Yeah.
Because maybe what the markets want can be found in various different options. If the markets are looking for stability rather than policy, then there are many options for stability that can be found. If the markets have people preferences, they must tell us who those people preferences are and why. I mean, this fear about the markets can't be the overwhelming concern that we all have going into this without, again, rationale about why things are the way they are, why people will react the way they do. The truth is, we cannot make all of our decisions in this country based on fear. And that's what it seems like. Whether it's fear of MK, fear of whatever, fear of the markets, fear can't be the sole basis on which we establish our polity and our governance systems. We have to be thinking bigger than that, broader than that. And then if the market, I said this to somebody the other day, what would happen if the markets turned around tomorrow and they say they want MK? Would we all just go, okay, yes, let's do that? Or they said they wanted...
I think you must consider stand-up comedy. But anyway...
but you understand the point that I'm making, that there's a lack of logic in just assuming that what the markets want, the markets get. There has to be some more dynamism in that argument. True. And we have to open ourselves up to the questions about why, at what cost, for whom, where does this lead us? And also, can we recover? So let's say there's a shock. Is that shock going to be a temporary shock for 3 weeks, 4 weeks? Will we recover from that shock? Are there other ways in which we'll recover from that shock? The one thing that we've learned over time, guys, and we must all just, you know, be very thoughtful about this, is that we've had market crashes before. And then we've had recoveries after that. Because no matter how we look at it, being a small open economy that we have created ourselves to be, it is actually very comfortable for business to be here, regardless of, you know, tinkering here, there, and other places. It's actually quite a comfortable place for business to be. The chances that they're all going to flee en masse are very small.
So it seems to me that the ANC is in a terrible corner in that they cannot form government without marrying one of what would have been their sworn enemies, or at least strange bedfellow, right? I mean, nobody would have imagined the ANC being in bed with the DA.
And, really?
Well, you know, just on paper. And you know, for the last 15 years, one would think the ANC and the AFF are done and dusted. Like, so, and now there's this MK factor, which what at least us lay people perceive is that there's no way in hell that the man from Kandla is going to be friendly with the man from Palapal, right? So, what's the AC going to do? What are they, I mean, because the other parties, I mean, IFP is another factor that they could use, but all other parties underneath that, if they excluded the EFF, the DA, and the IFP, and MK, they won't form government, right?
Yeah. And I guess that's the reason why the ANC has opened the floodgates, because they really are unsure about who's going to stay and who's going to go. And because they've not had the courage to say, this is what we prefer, they now have left themselves at the mercy of everybody staying or going. Then this brings us to the political maturity, the willingness, and even the strategy, the tactical strategy of all the other parties, right? So this kind of just blanket, we won't work with X if Y is in the room, is not sufficient, right? Y being in the room, can you out maneuver Y even while they're in the room?
Yeah.
So the EFF has, by all accounts, walked away from the GNU negotiation, and by Floyd Shivambu's utterances yesterday, have walked back in, right? Walked back into the room.
Yeah.
The question is, have they walked in with a strategy that says, "Beh," to the DA, that says, we're here, and these are the things that bring us here, and that if we can find a way to work around these things and pull you towards the things that we want, then we will stay here.
Well, the majority of the people listening to us now, all they've been hearing, and that includes me, is people coming in, except for the DA. People saying, if we come in, we want a position. And they even specify it, right? I mean, people are now calling out ministries that they're looking for. It seems to be that kind of parade.
I mean, in fairness to the EFF, they let go of their positional asks within a day of the results. They went, guys, we can see where this is going. We're not going to make demands. Maybe they've made new demands now, but that's also part of the problem. We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know what demands the DA's made. They might have been making positional demands up the wazoo. Mm. We don't know. We don't know what demands anyone else has made. That's the big problem that we have in this instance, is we don't know what the demands are. What we have heard is people saying, I won't work with X being in the room. I won't work with Y being in the room. And that for me is more worrying than the positional arguments. Because that says to me that we can't come here and fight around what are the policy things that we can have as a minimum requirement, right? And in coalitions, again, in coalitions around the world, one of the things that coalitions are able to do is actually to moderate each other, to be able to pull people from extreme positions you don't like closer to yourself, and at least come up with a minimum basket of things that people can agree on. Now, does that say that all of the people who I'd like in the room are in the room, or the people who I would like not to be in the room might be in the room? They might. I might have people in the room that I prefer not to have in the room. But if I can get the things that is necessary for us to make this country work agreed on in the document, then we have to pull on each other. And a coalition, and this is why I don't like the term government of national unity, because it assumes that once we are together, we are now married. A coalition isn't a marriage. It really isn't a marriage. What it is an agreement around how to pull each other and push each other, how we are going to moderate each other for particular purposes, for a particular period. It is not a lifetime agreement. It's not one party swallowing the other. It's not these parties giving up their identities for each other. They are having to do exactly what politics requires them to do. What Parliament should have been doing all this time is trying to do that push and pull to get each other closer to where the other
ones will be. Tessa, lead to positions and ministries, without a doubt, right? And so, I mean, one feels that some party may say, well, we need, which constitutionally won't work because the constitution doesn't provide for two deputy presidents, right? So if it's going to be one, does it mean Paul Mashatile gets in an aircraft and disappears like his counterpart in Malawi? What's going to happen here?
Let me tell you what would be more interesting to me if I was in those rooms. Deputy President, ceremonial. I'd be asking about Speaker. Because all of it is on the table, actually. Yeah. Right? So we're talking about ministerial positions. The positions in Parliament are extraordinarily important in this moment.
Chairs of the committees.
Chairs of the committees. SCOPA. All of that is important. The position of Speaker is probably the most important one in a context where you're thinking about potential impeachment, where the ANC now doesn't have a majority where it can just decide for itself. The Speaker can make decisions around whether things are heard or not, whether votes are done by secret ballot or not, whether certain ad hoc committees are allowed to be established or not. I mean, I would say something starting with a P and ending with an A. It should be a consideration. I almost wanted to do a poll. How many times do you think Palapala has been mentioned in the last 3 weeks? But, I mean, Parliament itself is a terrain of political power, and probably a more important terrain, I think, going into the next 5 years, whether you want to call it coalitions or government of national unity, and especially for us as voters and as citizens. Because Parliament is the boss of government.
Yeah.
That's how it's
supposed to be.
Absolutely.
And that's not been in the last 15 years.
It has not been in the last 30 years. Yeah. Why? Because the ANC has had government. And what it's done through its caucus is just passed things through.
Yeah.
Everything just gets passed through without scrutiny almost. And now the ANC doesn't have that majority. And it's trying to rebuild that majority through a government of national unity in a way that disciplines parties from not opposing it. I don't think that's going to work in the way that they hope it will work. Because if parties are smart and they say, we don't just want seats there, we actually want parliamentary power as well, then it becomes a lot less easy for the ANC just to push, for anyone to just push things through. We have 5 years ahead of us where we can actually contest power, where budgets aren't just going to be passed without actual scrutiny, where the debates in parliament actually become meaningful.
Because they haven't in the municipalities where we've seen coalitions, and so should that scare us?
So yes, it should scare us, but I think that we have a very different moment going on here. And especially this government of national unity thing, I think the ANC is not thought it through very well, right? Because I think it is trying to constrain and saying, here are the positions to constrain. But we haven't seen is an act of parliament or an act of council where the opposition actually goes through things with a fine-tooth comb. And actually, maybe I'm being disingenuous, because I do think that we've seen slower processing of things, particularly because it's harder just to push things through. Mm. We've seen changes because you can't just have your way. And so whether it's been done in smart ways or not, whether it's always been done in healthy ways or not, it certainly does set itself up for that. And I think we as the electorate have allowed things to happen at municipal level that I don't think we will as easily allow at the parliamentary level. And we shouldn't allow at the parliamentary level with as much ease. It's going to require more from us. I've been saying to people in civil society in the last few days, why on earth are groups that were vocal during the elections about the issues and the policies that they care about? You big, housing. There were so many agendas that were being brought forward in terms of, we will vote for you if this is the issue. Now you have a government of national unity being set up and you're quiet about your issue. You should be raising alarm about your issue right now. You should be coming into the parliamentary space and being able to say, where is the social protection budget? Why is the social protection budget not including UBIC? Who can I lobby within parliament in order to make sure that that becomes a priority? I spent about a week or so in the US last year, and I was trying to talk to civil society organizations about how they engage with politicians. And on the day, I was in Atlanta, Georgia on that day, speaking to social justice organizations. All of them canceled on me on that day. And it was because their Senate had called for a snap vote on an LGBTQI legislation for the state. And all of those civil society people put on their clothes and they went to the parliamentary floor, to the Senate floor, to go and lobby for the particular vote that they wanted. They went to go and lobby those politicians, one by one, group by group, party by party. Because they said, we want to know why you're voting, what you're voting on, how is this going to change things? We want to hold you publicly
accountable. That's a bridge too far for us. But anyway, finally, I suspect Gauteng, which is in the same dilemma as the national space, is going to have to take its cue from whatever happens in the conversations of the GNU or whatever it is that is there.
I mean, or the other way around. So, I mean, we spoke a little bit about KZN.
Yeah.
And so I think KZN and Gauteng are probably first being decided before the national is concluded. Because if you get those decided, then the national takes its cue from what you've been able to establish there. That's why I think what's happening in KZN is absolutely imperative to know whether or not it's going to hold, because it will have implications for the national rather than the other way around. The second thing about that is that the provinces have exactly the same time as parliament to constitute itself, 14 days. So in fact, in the next few days, we need 10 governments to form, not one. I would keep a very close eye, if I was anybody in this country, on what happens on Friday at KZN in the sitting of that parliament and what happens in Gauteng before I look at what happens at national. Because I think those two have a bigger impact on what happens at national than the other way around. And I think also those two, and particularly KZN, will tell us a lot about the response of the MK party to Friday sitting. I think Friday sitting in Cape Town will happen undisturbed. Whether KZN will be the same, with a 45% party feeling excluded from its own possibilities of governance, I don't know.
And on that note, dear follower of this podcast, I need to apologize to you because she came here to give us an idiot's guide to GNU. I feel more idiotic after this conversation, but I feel more empowered about other stuff. Tessa, it's been beautiful chatting to you.
You know, I will say for the Idiot's Guide, to everybody who's out there, my apologies that, you know, but I think that the Idiot's Guide in general terms is that nothing is certain and that we mustn't take for granted that political parties are just going to act in the ways that, you know, seem that they've acted in before. We have to stay plugged in all the way through. We did not elect a president on the 29th of May. We elected 400 potential presidents who then amongst themselves will elect a president on Friday. And we need to know that kind of detail as we look at the politics.
I'm grateful one of them was not Claudia Motsoeneng. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Taking the Rams by the Horns. Please send your comments to me via email on rams@ramsmabote.com. Let me know what you think of the podcast, and please tell us who should never, never be invited into the GNU. Download the My Sowetan app and listen to more of my podcasts. We are also on Spotify. Follow us on X @RamsByTheHorns and @SowetanLive. From me, Rams Mabote, goodbye and God bless.